It's been a problem for years, but now the NFL is tackling head-on the danger of concussions. But is the league doing enough? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we've got a look inside the Florida Times Union investigation into concussions and football. What a hot topic, and lots of comments already coming into the show. You can add yours. Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, the ancient classic Greek comedy Lysistrata takes a local stage, an old tale with some modern relevance. We'll tell you about that. And She's the May Woman with Heart, a conversation with Danny Atkinson about the local nonprofit Volunteers in Medicine and how you can help. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it is the open secret destroying pro football players' lives after they leave the field. For years, the National Football League concealed the dangers of concussions from both the players and the fans. The cover-up of the medical dangers of concussion to the brain eventually led to a nearly billion-dollar concussions settlement with former NFL players back in 2015. Now, since then, many changes have been made at the professional level to try to better protect the players. But have those changes been enough? And what about the dangers of head injury to high school, college, and even children's football leagues? Increasingly, parents today say they don't want their children playing Pop Warner or high school football as the dangers of concussion become more widely known. Reporter John Reed of the Florida Times Union has been spending months looking into concussions and football at all levels. His story is published in the paper this week, and he joins us now with more. John, good to see you.
Good to be here.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about concussions in the NFL, even high school football, Pop Warner football? Do you think football is too dangerous? Do you think the NFL is doing enough to protect the players? What are your comments? We want them. So call us up right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And as always, we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Okay, so John Reed, you come at this from a very personal angle. You played football at Rebald High School, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And did you play Pop Warner too as a kid?
I played, I started when I was 9 years old in the fourth grade and went all the way through to the 12th grade. So
so you know the game and you love the game, I'm guessing.
Well, I love this game. I mean, there's so much that you can get from the game other than the competition-wise. I mean, you learn about responsibility, you learn about being on time, and you learn, well, you do learn about competition because in the work, place. You have to perform at a level to maintain that job. And when you have a position on the football field, you have to show your talent to hold that starting position. But there's a lot of good things about this game, but it's also some problems.
Sure. And your piece, I think, does a beautiful job of explaining the problem. Now, as I mentioned, the NFL had a nearly billion-dollar settlement with former players 3 years ago to make them whole for their medical injuries suffered on the field, concussion and a more serious injury to the brain. It's known as CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's a degenerative brain disease caused by repetitive hits to the head. And so the NFL has tried to address some of the players' injuries. They've made 49 rule changes, you report, since 2002 to make the game safer. They now have no less than 27 medical professionals on hand at stadiums for every game. And as you report in the TU, they recently have broadened their helmet hit rule for the 2018 season, and they are penalizing players who lead with the crown of their helmets on plays. And this came after nearly 300 player concussions during the last season. So tell me a little bit more about this change in the NFL. They're now penalizing players that lead with the top of their head on a play.
Well, interesting about that new rule is an offensive player can be penalized if they lower that head before the impact of a defender coming in to tackle them. That's the same problem for a defensive guy. But I think it's a step in it. There are some players in this league who feel that's a little too much, you know, the lowering of the head. Because a lot of guys would feel in football, it's a natural response to lower yourself, to brace for that tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the steps are being made by the NFL is that no way to use that helmet at all to make any type of impact. And the more rules you have in place to not allow any contact with that helmet is the rule that needs to be put in. And I think the biggest problem with a rule like that, how do you enforce it? I mean, do you really? You might have a situation if it's going to be a 15-yard penalty, but how blatant that penalty will be can also subject a player to being thrown out of the game. So the NFL said that they're going to have a situation where they go to each of the 32 teams during the training camps to explain this rule, because I think it needs to be explained and it also needs to be interpreted. What is legal, what's not legal, and those kind of things. But I think as far as a step in the right direction, that this league has to find ways to make this game safer.
Mm-hmm.
And over the past, there's been a lot of helmet-to-helmet contact.
And a lot of injury.
And a lot of injuries because of that.
And we'll go to your calls for reporter John Reed of the Florida Times Union in just a moment as we look at his investigation into concussions in football. Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, as you mentioned, some NFL players are saying these rule changes make football not football anymore. I think a player for the Redskins tweeted, "This isn't the game that I signed on to play." And so that is one aspect of this really interesting story. Some players are saying, oh, here's the tweet. Redskins safety DJ Swearinger said, "This is obviously not football anymore. The game we love is getting destroyed." So players in some cases are protesting these rule changes that the NFL owners adopted just last month down in Orlando. Now, at the same time, let me ask you about this, John, because in recent years, doctors have learned so much about the damage that's caused by concussions and CTE, the degenerative brain disease that's caused by repeated hits to the head. The first former NFL player was diagnosed with CTE back in the early 2000s. Now, more than 100 former players have received a post-mortem diagnosis of CTE. They can only fully diagnose it after they're dead. But it's a very serious brain disease, and it's caused by repetitive hits to the skull. I think back to that movie Concussion that starred Will Smith, and he played the doctor that first published the first confirmed case of this and how the NFL pushed back on it. At the same time, we're seeing increasingly youth football is part of this. High school and even Pop Warner football, there's a danger to kids. A 2015 study found that former NFL players who began football before the age of 12 fared more poorly on cognitive assessments than those who started later in their teens. And so what is the future for this game if more and more parents are looking at the studies that have been done on brain injury, seeing what's happened to the players? So many of them, after they leave the game, they suffer depression, cognitive degeneration. Sometimes they even lash out violently because they are dealing with all of this brain injury. What's the future of this game, John, if enough parents eventually say, you know what, this just isn't safe. I don't want my kid out there on the Pop Warner field. I don't want my kid playing high school football. Is this revelation that you're uncovering and that other reporters have uncovered about football and the dangers of concussion, is this a canary in the coal mine for the decline? I know it seems unthinkable to so many fans, but the decline of this sport in America.
Well, let me go back on that question when I was a player and just give you an example of what it was, you know, I mean, the change didn't start till about 5-6 years ago on how to make this game safer. But even when I played Pop Warner football, and even kids beyond that, tackle in practice was going on every day of the week when we were 9 years old. And the difference back in 76, 77, and you look at now at 2018, is you didn't have the science, you didn't have the, you didn't know what you know now. But every player, even then, took risk, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember watching television in 78, and I was probably, like 11 years old. I remember Daryl Stingley getting paralyzed on a hit by Jack Tatum on television in a preseason game that didn't matter.
Live on TV.
It was live on television, and I remember that. And when you see that as a child, I mean, you think about it because you think that it can happen to me.
Did you ever get a concussion yourself while you played?
No, didn't get a concussion, but I've covered high school football a long time. I covered it like 13 years. And I used to cover games on the sideline, and I can recall players would get hit in a helmet-to-helmet hit and walk off that field staggering, and the coach would pull them to the side, if you okay, and they ask those standard questions like, where are you at right now? How many fingers I got up? And about 3 minutes later, that quarterback was back there on the field.
Mm-hmm.
I think what this game is going to have to come down to is you got to have a change of philosophy of, you got right now in 2018, you got football coaches out there on the football field coaching these kids and telling them that you, in order for you to be successful in this game, you got to be a physical player. You got to endure punishment, and you got to receive it, and you got to give it. And that change is not going to happen unless these coaches understand the seriousness of these medical studies. This football, this sport has never been analyzed like it's being analyzed right now.
Sure.
There's never been scientific evidence like what they have right now when they're saying that from CTE to concussions. I mean, if you don't take a child out of the game, and that possibility that the kid has had a concussion and comes back and have another one in the same game, it could be long-term problems for that child with concussion and the second impact syndrome. And I think the coaches now have to understand, I don't think that you have to have tackling drills at practice 4 days of the week and then have a walkthrough on Friday and play on Saturday. I think that part of football should be abolished. And the more you get I think the biggest part of all this below the NFL and also the colleges, the coaches have to understand that the risk now outweighs the wins. And they got to be they're the one in charge of the practices. They are the ones who put in the plans of contact, how many times you're going to have contact practices during the week. And those studies, by the research studies, shows that more concussions occur at practice than in games.
Than in the game. And you know, it's interesting to note that football, it is still the most popular sport for high school boys. But at the same time, the number of high school students playing football dropped by about 25,000. In the 2016-17 school year, as more of these studies become more widely known. Even former star quarterback Brett Favre said he would prefer that his grandsons play golf, mm-hmm. not football, knowing what he knows now. Let's go to your calls for reporter and former player John Reed of the Florida Times Union, a landmark new piece in the paper about the dangers of concussions in football. What are your questions and thoughts? 549-2937. Tom is on the west side right now. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I played football a zillion years ago, and one thing that I think is definitely contributing to the amount of injuries today is they don't tackle the way they used to. When I played football, they told us to get in front of the play, come under control, and then make the tackle. There was none of this running and flying through the air at the point of impact, which creates so much more violent collisions on the field. Another thing that I've noticed is in the NFL, unlike college football, there is no rule for players that lose their helmets. In college, they have to come out for a play if they have their helmet on in a fashion that's not secure. And I think that's something that the NFL needs to adopt, because the collisions are much more severe there.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Tom. You know, here are some of the changes that they have adopted. They've banned helmet-to-helmet hits. They've made kickoff plays a little safer. They've limited the amount of contact allowed in practices. I've read, John, that they're even looking into artificial playing surfaces to soften the blow of impacts. They have a five-step protocol for injured players to return to the game. So you've reported on a lot of these changes. What about Tom's call? Are these changes, I think the main point of your article is, are these changes enough? Is this such an inherently dangerous game that no amount of tweaking can make it safe?
Well, no, but I think that it's got to be a situation where people understand that the seriousness of CTE, the seriousness of concussions is warrants the change of philosophy in this game. I just feel that too many coaches and even players, you're not going to get a player from Florida, I don't think. I mean, I'm just speculating, but let me ask you this question. You're not going to get a football player from Florida, even though he signs a contract basically saying, if you see a teammate suffering concussion symptoms, maybe on the Tuesday, they played Saturday and they play and it's Tuesday getting ready for the week of playing the Georgia Bulldogs. It's your responsibility to let the athletic trainers know that your teammate is suffering from concussion symptoms. Like he might be wobbling or dizzy or a speech impairment or something. Mm-hmm. It's that athlete's responsibility to go to the athletic trainer and say, well, he's not functioning right. You might need to take a look at him. There's not going to be a lot of players with that philosophy, so much at stake in winning, so much at stake at trying to get to the NFL and those kind of things, that you're going to have an athlete to go to the trainer's office and say, look at that athlete when he's the starting quarterback. And I think the biggest issue right now, this is not going away. Science is only going to get better. And from the NFL on down, and I say the NFL has the biggest responsibility, because it's a $1 billion industry, and a lot of the leagues from colleges to Pop Warner to high school follow what they do, because they are the you know, more people follow it than any other sport in the world. So they got to take more of a proactive stance and be like the big brother to these other levels of football. Mm. And I think they're doing that, but I think this is a process that's going to go on. And I think the parents of a 5, 7, 8 year old has to know the circumstances of having their child play football. And I also think if you're going to have that coach and have these kids out here on the practice field and they're tackling against each other, then I think if it's going to be tackling at practice, then it should be the responsibility of someone that they should have a health professional out there watching these kids while they're tackling each other, because it's that serious.
Let's go to Perry. Perry in Ponte Vedra now. Hi, Perry. Good morning. Perry, turn your radio down and go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead, Perry.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I played high school football in the 1970s, and I was the recipient of a incredible helmet that had been developed by Riddell for Larry Zonka after all of his concussions. And once I strapped that helmet on, I had a weapon. And compared to the other canvas webbed helmets, I mean, it was a huge difference. Now, having said that, you know, I'm seeing the development of helmets. And what I'm concerned about is that the helmets that are going to be required to protect, you know, from even from inadvertent headshots are going to be so expensive that possibly only the big, big college teams and the NFL will be able to afford to outfit their patients, I'm a doctor, sorry, outfit their players with a helmet that really will protect them. I'll go on to say that as a trauma surgeon resident, the patients whose, it sounds graphic, the patients whose heads were cracked, you know, the cranium was cracked in an accident, they actually recovered more than those whose heads didn't, because the energy was dispersed around the head as opposed to into the brain. And my feeling is that when we develop helmets, they're going to have to break and then be discarded. And that's going to be very expensive.
Thanks, Perry. Okay. Is there a way to make a helmet that is protective enough to forestall some of these horrible medical outcomes, John Reed?
Well, technology in helmets is improving. The NFL also are evaluating helmets more. I think they threw out like about 7 different models about, they had studies of those helmets this past season and they didn't make the grade and they basically obsolete. The NFL is no longer going to use them. Vicious is a helmet. I think Ponte Vedra High School is going to be using this new state of the art helmet. The NFL rates that as the number one helmet. And also, speaking to Alan Seals of the he's the medical doctor for the NFL, he projects that within 3 to 5 years that the NFL is going to have specific helmets for each position. And it'd be based on studies of where, like, the quarterback usually get hit from the side, that they'll have different protections just specifically for where the quarterback over a period of time is getting most of those contact hits in the head from. And I think that goes right back to scientific knowledge and scientific advancement of this football game as itself. And I think one of those advancements over the years is going to be helmet technology. And hopefully the cost is the biggest issue below the NFL. And hopefully that the high schools and the youth can have these type of helmets that's being used by the NFL, because it's all about protection.
Lauren tweets the show, "My brother rode BMX bikes and raced go-karts starting at about 6 or 7 years old. In both sports, I remember them bragging that it was statistically safer than tackle football." So other sports recruit based on telling parents, you can have your kid do this, they'll be safer than if they go play football. That's not, you know, what's amazing to me is that knowing what we know now about the dangers of this sport, that it's still so wildly popular. That's a real conundrum, isn't it?
With all this scientific knowledge, I think you're going to find players to take risks. You're going to find athletes in high school
That know the risk, but want to do it anyway.
But the gain is, this might be their only chance of getting a college scholarship.
Yeah.
And for a lot of kids, that outweighs the risk. And I just think,
is that why you played?
Yeah, that's why I played. Man, my brother played. I mean, I had cousins that played. And you watch this game, you see the NFL. As a kid, I used to watch. I mean, back in Jacksonville in the mid-70s, we didn't have the Jaguars, so the Buccaneer games would be on, and that's what we'll watch. But our household was around NFL football on Sundays.
Right, and for so many millions of households, that is a ritual. It's a uniquely American ritual. But, you know, I know your piece is about the NFL and concussions, but you bring up a larger point, which is that for a lot of young men, playing football is a way out of a bad situation. It's a way to better themselves socioeconomically, get a scholarship, get into a better life if they can get there. That brings up the larger issue, which is that if this is such a dangerous sport, and so many young players see it as their only option, societally, we need to be creating other options for young students who want to find scholarship opportunities and want to better their lives other than playing football. You know, former Jaguar player Rasheen Mathis was on this show several months ago, and he, you know, he kind of told the same story. He said, look, you know, I could take any kind of ball, a football, a soccer ball, a basketball. That was my talent. And I knew that if I didn't develop that talent, I wasn't going to get anywhere in life. So I just focused only on that or mainly on that. And that's how I, you know, made something of myself. And he went on to this great career in the NFL, but he was one of the lucky players. He didn't get injured. He didn't suffer this devastating brain injury that hundreds of players have now suffered. And when they do these postmortems on the guys that they've now confirmed have CTE, John, or were walking around this planet with CTE years after their career ended, the disease to the brain is just horrific. It seems like a steep price to pay for a few years of glory on the football field.
But science, we didn't know that 10 years ago. I believe the NFL knew it, but they didn't
go public with it.
To talk about it. And I think you have to put it within anything in life. I mean, I want to preach on that, but anything in life, you're going to have risk involved. And I will still sit here today and say, if I had to do it over again, and I still know the risk, CTE, you can be paralyzed, I will still play this game. Because as a man, I look back at my childhood and I've learned more. I still have friends that I played football with at 9 years old. I'm still friends with a lot of those guys. I'm still friends with my teammates that I went to Reebok with. We share cookouts and families. We talk about those old times that we had on that football field. And there's some things in life that you can't put a equation on it. You can't duplicate it. You can't understand what that really means. I mean, some people say, yeah, you went to battle, but it's more than that. You learn from each other. You talk about things in life. You're on the bus rides to the high schools and your bus rides in Pop Warner where you share things and you talk about your experiences. You wish people that you've seen. I played with guys that's in it, that played in the NFL, and they come back and they share their experiences. Some of these guys live their lives through you because you didn't make it. And it's tough to just say, with those risks that's involved now, that you walk away from that and say, I don't want to play this game. And that's what some of these guys are feeling, that it's a bond that you're never going to get in anything else, that I feel with that much togetherness. You out there on the field, you lose a game, you pick each other up. And as far as like in high school, that was something that you couldn't get in any other activity that I know of in high school. And I didn't want to be a football. I mean, I wanted to be a journalist in high school. And I knew that I probably wasn't going to be good enough to extend my football career beyond that. So I wanted to have something, and I thought at 17, to put me somewhere that I could be around that game. And I chose journalism, but it still comes back to football.
And so many men love football. My husband's one of them, you know. It's such a deep love. And as I hear you talking about it, I can feel it and see it in your face. The togetherness, the brotherhood, the camaraderie, the discipline, all of those things. But integral to the game is violence. Can football exist without violence? Because it really is the hidden bloodlust, the hidden violence in human beings, I think, that drives enthusiasm for the game. It's a way to symbolically express that by watching these really talented athletes go at each other on TV every weekend. And the price they're paying for that is increasingly becoming something that I don't think the NFL is reconciling.
No, they're not. I think they're in a position that this league, the NFL, has to. I mean, I go to those practices in the Jaguars. I see 14, 15 athletic trainers out there on the field. I see when a player get injured, they immediately off the field. But it's so much more involved than that. It's this league has to be the front runner. And I also feel with the billions that they make, they're going to have to put even more of that money into research to discover what can be done to alleviate this problem. I mean, the lawsuit and paying the former players in that lawsuit and compensating them, that's one thing. But there's, so as you said, that there's so many more players that's coming up through colleges, coming up through the youth leagues, and they're putting themselves in this situation. Once they, you don't have to be an NFL player to be diagnosed with CTE. Mm-hmm. But I think the responsibility has to be on the coaches. I feel strongly about that. I feel they control what happens at practice. They control the philosophy of the players. They demand physical play, but they control how much contact goes on at practice. The NFL has, during a 18-week season, that you can only have 14 contact practices. It's the choice of the football coach to decide when they have those contact practices. And in college, you know, you got Buddy Tevens right now at Dartmouth, who has no contact drills at all. And Ivy League has no contact drills at all for the regular season. There's been no other conference in this country that followed them. And Buddy Tevens had put in that rule since 2010. It's been 8 years.
And no one's followed. But we will continue to follow this story. And I encourage everyone to read John's story in the Florida Times Union. And it's live on Jacksonville.com. A look at the NFL, football, and concussions. John Reed of the Times Union, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And much more still ahead, meanwhile, later on the show, how you can support volunteers in medicine this month. But up next, it's a modern take on the classic ancient Greek comedy, Lysistrata. We'll tell you about it back in a moment.
The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater, Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk, sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
When you think of Milwaukee, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Do you just drink beer all day?
Just be honest. No one's listening, so just what do you do? Do you drink beer all day?
Yes.
Yes.
There's a certain amount of quality control checks you must do.
Live from Milwaukee, beer and all other things watery. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. It's the timeless comedy by Aristophanes, written more than 2,000 years ago. But the ancient Greek classic Lysistrata is pretty timely today. Now, the play is a body comedy celebrating both the power of women and a condemnation of war. In the story, the women of ancient Greece use the only weapon they have to stop their men from fighting. They withhold sex. It's a story that shines a light on the intersection of politics, power, lust, greed, not to mention the battle of the sexes. And a classic theater in St. Augustine is bringing Lysistrata to life. Three performances only during the Romanza Festival of the Arts this May in the nation's oldest city. Lysistrata director Harolyn Sharp joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Lysistrata is the heroine in this story, and she convinces women from Athens and Sparta to stand united in ancient Greece, sort of the first ever women's liberation movement. In order to end the Peloponnesian War, they just stop having sex with their husbands. And it works.
And it works. Yeah. Aristophanes has painted a strong, clear, articulate, I call her the first Me Too leader, too many years ago to even do all that math. And when I hear Lysistrata's lines, such as the chronic belly aches of the Senate, the graft, the raucous caucuses, the unraveling of the general welfare, I think, wasn't this written yesterday? That it really, really is timely. And these women retreat to the Acropolis, board up the door, hold the Senate's treasury, and refuse sex until the men stop fighting. And what I'll do is invite you to come and see what happens.
And you don't want to give away the whole story.
I don't want to give away. And so you'll have to come and see, I'll call it the climax of the play.
Okay. All right. So what prompted the decision to have a classic theater in St. Augustine choose this particular production? And by the way, it's three performances only this month during St. Augustine's Romanza. It's the Festival of the Arts.
Correct. And that is May 11, 12, and 13. So that's a Friday, Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2. And in a way, it's ironic that that's Mother's Day weekend. So I've decided to call that a powerful story of women. Mm-hmm. Bring your mother for the matinee on Sunday. And this is at Flagler College in the Ringhaver Student Center, the Gamache Koger Theater, which is a very intimate little theater, only seats about 100, so that makes it very interesting. And to answer your question, I do not know. I was invited to direct after that decision had been made.
But were you familiar with the play?
When they asked me, I was not. And I thought, surely, 100 years ago in college, I read that. But I didn't remember, so I went to the library and checked it out and thought, wow. This is so timely. And it is part of the mission of a classic theater, their mission to bring not only original pieces, but classic pieces. So that is part of their mission to bring to St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm. Lysistrata, it's my understanding, as we've been saying, it was written more than 2,000 years ago by Aristophanes. It was first performed in Athens in 411 B.C.
B.C.
And so for over 2,000 years, this play has been almost continuously performed.
Yes.
I don't know of that many works that have stood that kind of test of time.
That test of time is absolutely amazing. And again, the fact that it is still applicable when we can read lines from the script and think, good night, didn't I just hear that on the radio this morning or this afternoon? And another note that I want to address is the style of this production. We are doing it in Reader's Theater style, and a true classic definition of that is often called the theater of the mind. Scripts are visible to honor the writer. Minimal action and minimal sets are used so that you, the audience, can participate in the visualization of what is being presented.
You know, as I'm looking at all the different versions of Lysistrata that have been performed over the years, the basic story has been tweaked and remade from the classic ancient Greek production to all sorts of other versions. There's been a ballet, there's been an opera, there's been a rock musical on Broadway. There's just been a huge number of adaptations of this.
Well, I think
that says to me that it really strikes a chord with
people.
It
does. Over and over, yearly, weekly, monthly, of what we will hear. And the other note I will bring up is in all of these years and all of these different translations, and we are using a version that was written by a native of St. Augustine who was a faculty member mm-hmm. at Flagler College, and her nephew is deceased, but her nephew will be a part of our opening night and has come to rehearsal one night. And so different language adaptations maybe is a way to say that. We're still retaining some of the rhythms and the rhymes of those early ideas and the early language. So that gives us a connection to the past, but with our 2018 imagery, maybe.
Do you see this as an anti-war statement, this play? Is
Absolutely.
It a statement against war more than anything?
Absolutely. And it is also many repetitive lines about the power of women. There are lines about what all you men did when you told us to shut up and what you messed up in the Senate with the Treasury, with our finances. And there's a line where the men say, well, but you just did the finances at home. And they're saying, mm-hmm, we can make those decisions. We can control it. We know what we're doing. So there are often the repeated lines about the power of women, the wisdom of women. Let us show you.
And for an ancient Greek, that was pretty radical stuff.
Probably.
In those days, wasn't
probably.
It?
Probably. And we are doing the honor of the Greeks. It's minimal production, but yet when you think of a chorus line or something, but we are doing the standard time of wearing the togas and going to use screen images of ancient Greek.
Lysistrata is taking the stage this month in St. Augustine at a classic theater. It is part of the Romanza Festival of the Arts happening in St. Augustine all through the month of May. So you need to check out that full listing of events, too. But get your tickets now for Lysistrata, a story more than 2,000 years old, still being performed all over the world today. It's May 11th and 12th at the Gamache Koger Theater in the Ringhaver Student Center at Flagler College. May 11th and 12th. And Sunday, May 13th as well. Go to aclassictheater.org to get your tickets and see this production. Director Harolyn Sharp, what a beautiful voice you have, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. Thank
I loved
you very
listening
much.
To you.
Thank you.
Break a leg, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
A quick break, and in a moment, we'll meet this month's woman with heart carrying the banner and the diamond necklace to promote Jacksonville's own Volunteers in Medicine and how you can help this month. It's going to be easy. All you have to do is make a visit to a local salon. We'll tell you about that too, right after this.
The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater, Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com.
American companies have submitted more than 3,500 applications to get out from under the steel and aluminum tariffs. How's that going so far?
It's a pretty tedious process. You know, because there's not a lot of feedback.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Exemption anxiety, that and the day's business news, the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Are mega mergers and 5G on the horizon? The Time Warner AT&T trial comes to a close, and T-Mobile and Sprint take their second run at a merger. What could it mean for consumers' pocketbooks? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Is your tap water fit to drink? Studies suggest there's a 1 in 4 chance it's either unsafe or improperly monitored. In Flint, Michigan, officials say its water is safe to drink 4 years after its lead crisis came to light. But some residents don't buy it, and Flint is not even the nation's worst hotspot. How safe is our water? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, we want to make note of a birthday. A listener just emailed me this acknowledgement. Today is the 456th birthday of Mayport. Yes, on May 1st, 1562, French Huguenot Captain Jean Ribault sailed with three ships into the mouth of what he named the River of May, now the St. John's River. He met with the Timucua Indians on both sides of the river and exchanged gifts and put a stone piling into the sand to claim the land for France. 456 years ago, she says, Jacksonville should celebrate this event every year. You can celebrate, too, by visiting Fort Caroline this week and learning about the history of Ribault at the Ribault Monument. Thanks for that. Happy birthday, Mayport. And finally, this hour, there's an easy way you can support a great local nonprofit this month. All you have to do is head to a salon in Five Points. Now, this is all to benefit Volunteers in Medicine, an organization providing health care to the working uninsured of Duval County. Here with more, Danny Atkinson. She is this month's Woman with Heart for the organization. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And also here, Scott Redfield, owner of Redfield Salon in Five Points.
Good morning.
Hey, Scott. Okay, Danny, let's start with you. You're wearing a gorgeous diamond necklace shaped like a heart from Beard's Jewelry. You've been designated the May Woman with Heart for Volunteers in Medicine. The necklace is a way to promote the cause of providing health care to the working uninsured. So what's it like walking around town wearing this necklace?
Well, I just got it yesterday, and it's very sparkly.
Yes,
and,
it is.
Oh, yeah. And I can't wait to be asked about the necklace, because I'm sure people are going to notice it. I'm wearing an off-the-shoulder top today to make sure that it's
Can't miss it.
Yeah, can't miss it. Yeah.
Yes. And so all through the month of May, you'll be wearing the necklace to talk about Volunteers in Medicine. And they, through the volunteer work of doctors and other people, they provide health care to people who work but can't afford health insurance. And there are many of them.
Many, many. And it's a wonderful, wonderful clinic. It's located downtown. And I encourage everyone to possibly go and see the clinic and take a tour. They're happy to give tours. And it's an amazing, amazing facility.
It really is. And what you've done to sort of really drive the message home, in addition to wearing the necklace, is you've organized something really cool at Redfield Salon in historic Five Points. Scott Redfield, you're the owner.
Yes.
You've got an event coming up Friday, May 17th at Redfield's. It's called the Three B's, and it's all to support Volunteers in Medicine. What's going to be happening?
So the Three B's, it's bubbles, blow dries, and beauty. So it's focusing on beautying women, allowing them to come in, have a great time, have some you know, Prosecco from Bacardi. Got some great sponsors. We also have Sephora coming in doing makeup. Just, you come in, it's a great time for everyone just to enjoy, to support a great cause. I'm really happy to allow my space to be a part of the giving back of the community. Opening up that space in Five Points was you know, getting into the community, and they've been nothing but supportive to us. So I'm happy to give back to them.
And I believe you just won a Best of Jack's Award,
we
too.
We did, yes.
Congrats to you.
Thank you.
You're right next to Corner Taco in Five Points.
Yes, right on Post Street.
So right there on Post. So basically, people need to just come out. They can come visit you anytime, of course. But if you come to the salon on Friday, May 17th, you will get the benefit of this amazing event, Bubbles, Blow Dries, and Beauty, Prosecco, hors d'oeuvres, gift bags, makeover courtesy of Sephora, a silent auction. It's going to be a fabulous party, and it all benefits Volunteers in Medicine, Danny.
We're so excited.
Yes. And is that all people have to do is just come to the salon?
They actually, if they go to www.vim-jax.org, they can donate. And then it's a two-step process. They call up Redfields and book their time slot to get their blowout.
To get their blowout. Very nice. We can't have enough of those in life.
No.
Could you come and do that every other day?
Be happy to.
That would be my dream come true. Unfortunately, dreams don't always come true, but they can on Friday, May 17th. If you go over to Redfield Salon in Five Points, go ahead and do this. Go to vim-jax.org first and schedule your appointment and make the donation to support the working uninsured of Duval County. Scott Redfield, so good to see you.
Thanks
for being with us. He owns Redfield Salon in Five Points. Danny Atkinson is the May Woman with Heart for Volunteers in Medicine. What a beautiful necklace. They're going to have me wearing it in December. So you're going to have to give me some tips, Danny, on how to make sure I don't scratch it or lose it. Or I'm a little nervous about this, frankly.
It's very sparkly.
I know.
Very sparkly. Nobody's going to miss it. And it's going to give me an opportunity to talk about why I'm wearing this beautiful heart.
Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
All right.
That's going to be a fun event. I'm going to have to come to that myself.
Please do.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs our board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, 4 years after Flint, a renewed focus on lead levels in water. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for music. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.